You can hear us around the world, streaming 24/7 at safetyfm.com.
Streaming live from Taos, New Mexico.
Here is Dr. Jay Allen on Safety FM.
Broadcasting live from the Safety FM studios in Orlando, Florida, here is your host, Dr. Jay Allen, on Safety FM.
This episode of the broadcast and the podcast is brought to you by Safety Focus Moments. They're consultants that want to help you get the safety culture you've been looking for. For more information, go to safetyfocusmoment.com.
Well, hello and welcome to Safety FM. This is Jay Allen. Well, thank you for listening to the podcast and the radio show over the last few weeks, specifically the few last episodes dealing with how did it all start? The story of human and organizational performance, at least from the DOE point of view. Well, today I am not going to actually continue the conversation, but we're going to take some interesting twist. Today I had a great opportunity to sit down with Todd Conklin and discuss his career and his books. As you are aware, we recently have released 3 out of his 5 books on Audible. So I thought it was a great time to have the discussion of how the journey went between book to book, the career, and everything Todd has done till this point. Now, you'll notice as you're listening to part of this interview, I did use part or segments of it for How Did It All Start, the interviews that we've been doing over the last few weeks. But before we get into the interview, let's have a brief discussion. People keep on asking when the roadshow is coming about and all that. We have posted on the website, safetyfm.com, the upcoming roadshow that is taking place on August 5th. It is taking place in Daytona Beach, Florida. Oh, yes, you did hear me correctly. That's Daytona Beach, Florida. I will be there with Sheldon Primus from the Safety Consultant Podcast. And we're doing more of a workshop that particular day. And then we're going to be doing some segments of the road show directly. So we'll go ahead and record podcast live right there. And we'll even stream directly onto the radio station. And that's safetyfm.com. We're always available at the Alexa skill, the iOS app, and the Google Play Store. And of course, you can always stream us directly off of any internet browser that you have, of course. And then the other thing that has come up recently was there was a lot of requests for the Safety FM logoed shirts. We have released them finally. So they're actually up. You can actually go to safetyfm.com, click on shirts, and we'll get you directly into the store. You can place your order right there for the shirts. Besides that, let's just get you directly ready for this episode with Dr. Todd Conklin. He's the first person to ever have a repeat interview on Safety FM. So let's call this episode, Todd Conklin Comes Again, here on Safety FM.
It begins in Orlando, Florida, and travels steadily to the west, beaming across North America and planet Earth.
And into your head.
The world of safety never stops. And now, the Safety FM podcast and broadcast with Dr. Jay Allen.
We have this conversation is really go down the path of right now that we're getting to the lines where you're doing your first book. And I guess the real reason why I wanted to have this conversation was, well, we've been looking at all of your books across the board. So I want to go back and have the thought process on when you're doing them and then other things that are going on in your life at the same time. So it's a trip down memory lane.
Okay.
So give or take right here, 2004, you decide to write Simple Revolutionary Acts. And we're talking June is what I can find, unless you tell me otherwise. The purpose at the time, what were you thinking about doing that you decided to move forward with this?
So that was really interesting because I was working with Coca-Cola. And I was working full-time at Los Alamos. And then because Los Alamos is operated by the University of California, you could do this thing called a 701 form, which was a permission to do outside work. And it was a conflict of interest form, which does a people that listen to the podcast who work in any kind of government job totally know what that's about. And so I was doing this work with Coca-Cola, and we were working on reliability. We were really working on reliability from the safety and security side. And the director...
So his name was Bill McGrath, really good guy. And he said, you ought to write a book. And he said, if you write a book, we'd be interested in, you know, we'll we'll buy some. So I thought, well, I wonder what I should write a book about. Because at the time, I mean, this is kind of pre the New View stuff a little bit. And we're really just starting to dance around this notion of reliability, connected with psychological safety, connected with the culture of the organization. So I looked at a book and thought, well, it strikes me that what we're really wanting to do is, at the time, I was thinking revolutionize the workplace. But now if I had to do it, I'd probably say disrupt the workplace. But Revolutionary Acts is really based upon this notion of disruption. But it was kind of before the word disruption became a popular term to talk about it. And I had spent a bunch of time working with Edgar Schein on culture stuff, because he's kind of the dude for culture stuff. And he sort of led me to thinking about maybe writing the book so kind of one page represented a small revolutionary act you could do in the workplace that could happen at any level. It could happen at a leadership level. It could happen at the worker level. And it was relatively effective. It was kind of a fun book to write.
Now, at this particular time in your life, are you already doing the stuff with DOE? Are you already working on that program or not yet?
So we're not, we haven't started it yet in the DOE. It's still a little before that, but it's coming really soon. So it's going to be right around the corner pretty soon. But at that point in time, we're still working with, we're just starting to figure out that culture and a more holistic view has impact on really reliable performance. So we're looking a lot at safety and a lot of security. But in the DOE, safety and security are kind of similar. I mean, they're not, but they're sort of managed kind of the same way. It's been an interesting journey, because initially we managed both safety and security with programs directed at the worker. And that Simple Revolutionary Acts book is really the first time when we started looking away from the worker being the problem to maybe the worker being the solution.
So do you look back now and kind of realize that this is kind of like groundwork if you were looking full scheme on really getting into human and organizational performance as you're moving forward?
Yeah, totally. And it's funny too, because since you encouraged me to read that book on Audible, I was really surprised at how well that book held up over 15 years or 16 years, however old. It's pretty old. And I really, really see this as kind of some of the initial groundwork to begin to sort of prepare the soil to begin the organization in a conversation that's more holistic, more systems-based in nature. And it's funny, I don't think, at least I can only speak for myself, I don't think I would have been as prepared to move in the direction I moved around the safety stuff had I not spent some time thinking about the disruptive stuff that Simple Revolutionary Acts kind of represented.
Well, the funny part is that as I listened to the book and really have read the book, it's interesting because it almost seems like it is groundwork that was built for the purpose of that. So hearing you say that it wasn't, it's amazing to hear, because it all seems strategic.
It's all just serendipity. I mean, but I think that's how change happens, right? It happens on kind of that arc. There's sort of an arc of change, or there's a maturity model or maturity. Some, you know, it kind of moves. And I think Coca-Cola made me think, because Coca-Cola probably thought about it first and said, you know, what you talk about with our people is really more of a holistic approach. You ought to write a book about it. And then I wrote a book about it, which made me think more about a holistic approach. And it made me think more about really the difference between free agency, the belief that workers have free agencies, that workers are in command and control of their own actions, and the belief that workers are actually part of a larger cultural environment. And if we want to change the worker, we don't ask the worker to be different. We change the cultural environment. So we do these disruptive acts. We take them to a movie, or we serve ice cream at a boring meeting, or, you know, we buy somebody lunch, those kind of little disruptive actions that really, now that I'm older, I don't know if I'm wiser, but I'm older, I see those now as really important to setting the stage for the change.
Well, I think that there are huge factors in there. So let's look a year ahead now down the road. And you don't have a book, quote unquote, per se, that comes out at the time, but July of 2005, I have access to the first lesson plan of Human Performance Fundamental course. What's the feeling there? What are you looking at as you're going down that particular path? I know it's not part of your book collection, but still, it's an important document to your career.
I find that. That's funny. Is it still the same slides? That's the big question.
Yes, they are. Believe me, I've done my research for this bad boy.
That would be the same, maybe. I mean, okay, July 2005, that's when we started working with IMPO. And that's when Shane and I would have initially probably started hanging out. And we started looking at the IMPO program, which was really, really quite extensive. Tony Mashara had done a ton of work, and it was quite extensive. And we started to apply it with the rigor of a nuke facility to kind of a non-nuke facility, even though it's kind of not non-nuke. Oh, there's a lot of negatives there, but we started applying it in a much more non-utility application. And it's funny because those initial slides, it'd be interesting to look at those, because at that time we would have been really fixated on error, on human error. Mm-hmm. And probably most of the conversation would have been around identifying error likely situations and putting tools in the system to reduce human error, which we now know is was a little bit of a fool's errand. But I think that was really important developmentally to starting the way we thought about human performance, because you really have to kind of start with understanding error, which then leads you to blame. And then once you really dig into blame and you start looking at the fundamental attribution bias and the things that sort of exist around blame, then that takes you back to error kind of for a second visit. But it'd be interesting to see those slides. What do you think about those slides?
Well, I thought they were pretty interesting, especially number one, the way that I was able to get a hold of them. And number two, if you look at those original slides, I mean, there's been some changes throughout the years for sure. But when you first see it, it references you and Shane, and it doesn't speak about the other people that are on there. And I thought that that was interesting, and not you know, just serving up to you and Shane per se, but looking at the different aspects on how it was built out, and then the amount of people that are there. And the lesson plans have been the thing that's gotten me pretty excited on some of just the foundational pieces on how they were supposed to be taught out, the length of the lessons, and so on. So it's just
really, we were pretty good at putting all that stuff out in the public. So I would imagine those lesson plans, the initial student guide, did you get a copy of that?
I'll have to double check for the student guide, because I didn't go digging for that, because I thought the handbook was it.
The student guide we put together at Los Alamos, which would have been pre-handbook.
Okay.
It was really good. It was really, really, really good. And I had that written. I had a team of grad students for a summer. And so I ran them through all the HP stuff we had and made them sit through a bunch of classes. And then I said, you know, what we want is a student guide. And the student guide, we decided we didn't want to give copies of the slides out, just because that's kind of, I don't know. Back in the day, that would be one more three-ring binder full of slides that you would never touch again.
Right.
So we spiral bound a student guide that supported the class. But it was really interesting in that it never had not even one copy of a slide in it. But every slide we showed was supported then by narrative, by actually research-based cited academic narrative to support all those slides, which is something you need at a place like Los Alamos or Livermore or Berkeley or Savannah River, the places where we would go and train, because our audiences were all, you know, for the most part, PhD research scientists. And they don't really they kind of know when you're making crap up, so you need to be able to cite stuff academically. And that was really fun. That student guide, if you don't have a copy of it, I bet you I have one. I saved some.
Okay,
they were really nice. They were really well done.
I would love to get a copy if you do have a copy.
I bet I do.
Now the other thing that I notice here is you have this DOE document, but all of a sudden in your book writing career, you don't have anything come out for another 7 years per se. Now, are there revisions going on during the 7 year period to the DOE stuff?
No, not so much. So pre the DOE document, was the IMPO document. And you should see a lot of similarities between the IMPO handbooks, if you have access to those. But the IMPO handbooks and the DOE handbooks are they're definitely cousins of one another. The other thing that happened between the IMPO handbook and the DOE handbook was that Decker's first book, the black and red, probably 100-pager, wouldn't very, maybe 110-page long book, Field Guide to Human Error, the Field Guide to Understanding Human Error, I think is the name, which would be the first version of that. That book came out, and that book rocked the world. But hardly anybody read it. It was really funny. When it came out, everybody acted like they read it, but you could totally tell who hadn't read it. And so when you find people that hadn't read it, you'd kind of bust their chops and make them read it. And then they'd come back and say, God, that I think is, I mean, I can say this, I think, without making Sydney too angry at me. That book was really powerful. It was his first one. And that really colored a lot of the DOE handbook. Not so much the tool, not volume two, the tools, but certainly volume one, the one that Lamar put together with everybody's help, on sort of the foundations, the concepts. That book was, I can't underestimate how important that first book was.
Now, do you feel that that was like an assisted guide to the DOE and INPO stuff at the time then? Is that how you're looking at this?
I think it would be more foundational. I think what it did was change the way that and Jim Reason's books as well, but that changed the way that Shane and I, and to a great extent Earl, and there was a cast of characters there that did that. It changed the way we taught the class, which then in turn changed the way the handbook was written, which that's when it starts to move a little bit away from the IMPO book. Remember, the IMPO book was written pretty early, and it was really, it was a philosophical as well, very well done. Tony did an amazing job. But it was written kind of under the old view, which was the idea that you would manage human error. And the Decker book helped us understand that that whole idea of managing error is really seductive, but it's not very practical. And that's when we started really looking more, even more so at kind of a systems approach.
So do you feel that he was using the INPO information to be kind of some of the foundational stuff moving forward for what he was doing research-wise for his book?
Who's he? Decker?
Decker. Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I don't think so. I'm going to have to ask him that question. But my guess is he probably did not have access to the INPO book, because at the time, INPO was really, really, really tight with who got their book. You had to be a member of the INPO, and you had to be a dues-paying member of INPO to have access to their material. And so I would imagine he did not have access to that book. I would actually tell you, if it's a chicken and egg conversation, it probably started with Reason stuff, then some of Decker's stuff, then the IMPO handbook, then Decker's book would have come out. They would have been written kind of in parallel. And then Decker's book and all that stuff kind of leads to the DOE handbook, which we knew we were going to write, and we knew it was going to be available publicly. I mean, everybody knew that, but nobody, I mean, Jay, nobody imagined in a million billion years that anyone would ever read the DOE handbook.
Especially as popular as they are now.
In a million billion years. I mean, I kind of thought we were putting together a handbook just for us. I knew it would be available. I mean, that's fine because it's taxpayer money. So I didn't have any problem with that. But I never imagined any other industry or any other organization would ever look at it. I mean, you just don't think about that. But that's kind of what's been interesting about this journey, is that it's been really a journey of self-discovery self-discovery is accurate, but I would say it's been a journey of each organization discovering about itself. And we never thought about this having legs outside of our own companies, our own organizations. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what Shane said, but I'll bet you Shane said the same thing. You never ever thought anybody other than our little laboratories would care about this stuff.
And we'll be back right after this on Safety FM. It is no secret that most successful organizations and professionals are data-driven. As the volume of data that businesses have access to increases, They need more efficient ways to turn the data into actionable insight. Fortunately, iDashboard offers a comprehensive business intelligence solutions to help you with data aggregation, preparation, analysis, visualization, and reporting. With the iDashboard's data hub, you can blend data from multiple sources to get a comprehensive view of related data. Then the intuitive dashboard builder gives anyone the freedom to create and design dashboards, and no programming experience is required. It's no wonder why companies like Lockheed Martin, Michigan Humane Society, and Navy Federal Credit Union trust iDashboards to provide them with the data they need to make the most informed decision for their business. Be sure to visit iDashboards.com/safety to learn more. That's iDashboard.com/safety. Make sure that you tell them that Jay Allen sent you. And we're back with more here on Safety FM. Well, it seems like it's been an interesting past, so let's kind of continue down the road here. So all of a sudden now we're in 2012, October, give or take, and the pre-accident investigation, an introduction to organizational safety, you decide to release it. What is the thought process before you get to this book? So why did you decide to go with this? Especially because already at this point, you're already teaching the DOE stuff. You've already done the other book, give or take, 7 years ago. So why all of a sudden do this introduction?
So this guy named Guy Loft, who worked for Ashgate Publishing in London, and Guy Loft was kind of their aviation safety and reliability editor. He contacted me and said somebody told him, I put quotes in here when I said somebody told him to contact me to put together a book. He thought there might be a market for a book that was written for the practitioner, not for an academic. And he asked that the book be written with no academic language, no long citations, no footnotes, and be written more like a conference speech and less like a textbook. And I said, really? And you're picking me? And he said, yeah, you're the person that we think can put this book together. Now, my guess is, speaking completely out of school, is that Decker probably told Guy Loft about me. And I asked Sidney Decker that, and he was really cagey and didn't answer the question, which totally makes me think I'm right. But what I did then with pre-accident investigation was basically write the fundamentals class down. And then put in case studies and put in some additional kind of information to reinforce some of the parts of the fundamentals class. But it wasn't a terribly difficult book to put together because I'd been teaching all that fundamental stuff for a bunch of years by now. And over time, and now we've got, you know, Decker's book, 10 Questions, Reasons, got maintenance, error, managing maintenance error. I'm trying to think if Eric Hallnagel, we're starting to read Eric Hallnagel, but we're reading mostly academic papers from him. There's not really a book out at that point that at least we had access to on Hallnagel. And we're starting to read a lot of, what's his name, Languishi, the guy that writes for Vanity Fair.
You know I'm going to pronounce it wrong, so continue.
Me too. But we're starting to read him, and we're starting to put together, now we're starting to, in a really kind of an applied way, putting together some of these theories, and we've got enough practice behind us, at least I should speak for me, I've got enough practice behind us because, you know, now we're rolling the program and it's running. And so we're doing much more system-centric investigations. We're starting to really look at learning. Los Alamos, you know, was really the first place to roll out the safety learning teams. We made up the, I can tell you where I was standing when we made up the name learning team, which is not a name I would have picked, but it's certainly a name that stuck.
It definitely
we had a lot of practice behind it. And so that book was really pretty fun to write. And the thing that I think made that book successful was whoever the editor was for that book at Ashgate was also the editor for Decker's books and for Reason's books. So the editor was kind of, in a way, smarter than all of us because that editor had really the sort of collective knowledge of all the Ashgate publications that were coming out around really this new view, we used to call it, the new view of safety or human performance.
So as you look back now, and you said that it wasn't a difficult thing to write, what are you thinking timeline that it took you to write the thing?
Honestly, probably maybe a month.
Okay. No, and it's interesting because they still sell the book on
driven with completion need. So when I start a project, it's very important for me to complete a project.
Okay. No, because it's interesting because it's still available online, and this is one of your only books that's available in hardcover.
Right, but that's just a choice.
Okay.
I wouldn't put any book in hardcover, because who the hell buys books in hardcover?
If we were talking by ourselves, I would give you that answer. But being as if we're on the air, I won't say.
Because the hardcovers are stupidly expensive.
Well, it is. I won't say the information's great, but it is kind of highly priced compared to some of your other stuff. Now, the only reason I asked if it was hard, was it hardcover, because did they try to do it at first as a textbook? Did they try to go that angle, even though they said they were told you to write it down?
And that's what Ashgate that was their model. And it is in a lot of libraries and stuff like that in hardback. That book has really sold a lot. It surprises me how many times that book sells.
So then now you're going forward. So now we go forward. Now, the pre-accident investigation, now, did you choose that name? What was the let me rephrase that. You chose that name for what reason? What was the purpose behind it? What clicked in your brain that that's what you wanted to do?
I thought it had good, it was attractive. The name was attractive. And I thought it would bring in more traditional safety thinkers and be kind of unoffensive and easy for them to grab hold of. Because even the most traditional, hardcore, behavioral-based safety person can get behind the idea of a pre-accident investigation. And it was built around the idea of sort of this idea of pre-mortems, which we kind of do in the Department of Energy, especially around like high explosives and stuff. Before you did a big, expensive experiment that you couldn't do many times, you would do a pre-mortem on it. And you'd say, okay, what are all the ways this could fail? And then you would actually dig into those. And that was a technique we were really comfortable with in the DOE. And so I kind of went with that name because I thought it would be attractive.
Well, then right now, it is a very attractive name, and nobody knew how well this name was going to stick, which this is the fun part. So now we start going a few years down the road, and we're not going to get to better questions yet, because before better questions occurs, you're still teaching and you're still going out to different organizations. But all of a sudden, the idea for the pre-accident investigation podcast occurs. And I look at that, because if you go back to your first episode, you're pretty much saying that you were coerced into doing it, and it's not something you really wanted to do. But now we're talking four or five years later, almost now, and you're still doing it.
Yeah, at least five years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that all started with the book was really getting popular, which again was kind of weird for me. And a friend of mine, my friend Jeff Segler, he said, you ought to, and he's kind of a new media guy. I mean, that's what he is a new media dude. He says, you need a YouTube channel. And I said, well, I don't want to do a YouTube channel because I don't look that good with without a shirt. You don't have to be naked in YouTube. And I said, well, who's going to be on YouTube if you have clothes on? I mean, that's a waste. And he said, well, if you don't do a YouTube channel, you ought to do a podcast. And then he said to me, and you'll appreciate this, Jay, he said, you know, you were in radio a really long time. A podcast will be really simple for you, and you ought to try it. And so I thought, well, I mean, maybe it'd be kind of fun. And what attracted me to the podcast was the fact that I got to buy a bunch of equipment, a bunch of sound equipment, which I don't know why that was attractive to me, but it was really attractive to me. So I ordered the dream microphone that I always wanted, just in case you're wondering. It's a SM7B.
Nice.
that's a dreamy. I think it's a great
one. It is.
And then I ordered a little mixer, and I looked up on the internet how to do a podcast, and I was blown away. I mean, I was really surprised how easy it was to actually do. I don't mean easy to do, but how easy it was to get your podcast up and out to the world. And so I started the podcast, And I never imagined, I don't know, like I thought maybe 50 people would listen. And I didn't imagine that it would be a thing. I mean,
you're being too kind. It's a juggernaut. You have thousands of listeners every day that download your podcast.
Yeah, I know. It's weird. And the funny thing is that I started with the interviews, and the first interview I did was Martha Costa, who's amazing. Actually, it's funny, I met with her today. And then I got like Tom Krause on there, and it's funny because at first it was hard to get people on, but then when it got popular, then it was really easy to get people on. And now it's kind of now you have to be really selective because lots of people want to get on and sell stuff. And you don't necessarily want to be somebody's advertising thing. So that was really interesting. And what's funny is it started out with just the interviews, and I was going to do one a week because you learn in radio that consistency matters. And I knew nothing about podcasting except that I thought somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes was long enough. And that if I was consistent, I could probably get people to listen twice. And if I could get them to listen twice, I might be able to get them to listen three times. And so I started doing the podcast. And then Tanya Legarmo, who was the human performance person really early for Chevron, I mean, like maybe the first person in Chevron to start thinking about human performance, she said, why don't you do operational excellence or safety moments? Because we really have a need for those. And so I thought, well, that'd be really easy. So I could do two dumps a week. I could do a safety moment and I could do an interview. And that's probably sustainable. And so that's kind of how the podcast started.
Do you still feel the same way that you did when you first started as you do now about it? Or has there been change on how you look at it?
That's a good question. It's still really fun. And it still doesn't feel like a lot of work. So that's good. I mean, that means I'll continue to do it because if it's fun to do and it's not a lot of work, I'll do it. It's also pretty easy to get people on. So that makes it a little easier. And I like it. I feel like it's something I'll continue to do for a while as long as it has value. I do think it's interesting in that a lot of people listen to it. And so I think it is a really, it's doing exactly what I wanted it to do, which is really build a sense of community among the safety professionals and reliability professionals, really, who are thinking these new ideas. Because at first it was pretty lonely and you would have these ideas and you'd go to an ASSE meeting at the time and you'd be the only person in the room who didn't think that looking at worker behavior for unsafe acts was valuable. And so you needed a place to go where you thought, oh God, there are other people that are thinking the same thing I'm thinking, and we need to build community with those people. And it's been pretty helpful. And so that was my goal. And at first I sold advertisements. Kinda. I mean, not really, but I had an advertiser or two at first because it was a way to buy the equipment because I just never imagined this would be a thing to invest in. So I thought, well, if I have to buy this microphone, which costs, you know, I don't know, what does one of these cost? $300 or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll go on the light end. Yes, absolutely.
No, then I need to sell an ad. And then somebody told me, I don't know, I was out someplace and they said, take those ads off. That's stupid. And I thought, well, you know, I don't really need to. I mean, I already paid for the $300 microphone. I might as well just take the ads off. So I just took the ads off. And in a way, Jay, that's been really interesting because that gives you a certain amount of freedom, too, because I don't really have to make anybody happy. And some podcasts really make people angry. Like there's a guy in Australia who hates me. But I think that's kind of fun.
Well, you have to also understand for what you tell people, you're not the most loved individual because of the concepts that you're bringing up. So you know that.
Well, and they're controversial. They're less controversial now than they were 15 years ago, they're even kind of less controversial now than they were 5 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Now, let me ask you just a strange question. We're going to get to better questions here in a moment. But if you were to retire tomorrow, do you feel that you would continue with the podcast?
Yeah, probably.
Does it bring you that much joy?
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I like it. It's really fun when you get to talk to people. I mean, it's fun. You must like doing it, don't you?
I love doing it. I've committed so much time to this. And of course, the radio station, which you know that you're on, we re-air your podcast like it's a standard show.
Oh, that's good. I think that's good. And more the merrier, man. I'm amazed at how much good stuff people have to say. Like almost every time I've talked to a person, I try to just have a conversation. Like I don't do pre-questions and I don't call them and rehearse stuff.
No.
I basically just connect with them and then I hit record. I try to hit record immediately so that even when we just start talking, we're recording. And then I just try to have the conversation. I never want to talk about what we're going to talk about beforehand because then we will have had the whole conversation in preparation to have the conversation. And the second time's not as good. And I'm kind of amazed at just how much there's just been a ton of really interesting stuff. And I've learned a ton from what people have to say.
Well, I think it's funny that you mentioned that because there's been times that we've been on the phone where you're like, don't talk about this to me because we're going to talk about it on the podcast. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, you don't want to have the conversation because some of the magic is just in having the conversation. I mean, the first time you have it, that's kind of when these really fresh, kind of green ideas squirt out, and then they become really interesting to think about.
Absolutely. So right now, let's go into 2016, and it's July right now. So you decide that it's going to be the release of Pre-Accident Investigation, Better Question.
Better Questions, yeah.
So what are you thinking between 2012 into 2016 that you'd see the need for Better Questions?
I start to realize that human error is not very interesting. In fact, it's so normal, it's kind of boring, and it's never causal. And I start to realize that the most important group that changes in this new view of safety differently, is not the workforce, the guys at the coalface, they kind of know all this stuff. It's leadership. And then I start to realize, really organically, I mean, I think I knew this all along, but I never saw it anywhere, and I never really studied it academically. I start to realize that the power in facilitating change is not in the answers. The power in facilitating change is in the questions. And that if I could get leaders to ask better questions, then the rest of it, the answer part, is really, really, really simple. And so I start to put my emphasis on how leaders ask questions. Maybe a better question is what leaders ask when they ask those questions. And now I'm at a point, I mean, this is back when that book is written, when I'm relatively convinced that the response that leadership has to failure is everything. And what's funny is that in the early stages of human performance, and this is where Tony Machar and I get a little bit crosswise, I would actually suggest that the IMPO stuff and the early, early, early DOE stuff was written towards the focus of fixing the worker. What I started to realize is that what we want to actually put our focus is on actually changing the way leaders lead for resilience. And that's when better questions becomes really an important part of it. And I write better questions mostly out of a desperate need to get people to sort of understand that if they want different answers, they have to ask different questions. And that's when sort of I come up with the idea that the enemy of the question is always the answer. And that answers actually do something really, really negative. And that is that answers actually stop inquiry. And the moment we stop inquiry is the moment we stop being resilient.
Come back next week for the continuation of Todd Conklin Comes Again, Part 2 on Safety FM.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
SafetyFM.com.
Wow, how things can change from one week to the next. Hey, hope everybody out there is staying healthy. I know everything is super crazy. We feel disoriented by the COVID-19 virus. It's more important than ever to stay connected and check in with your loved ones. That's why I'm so happy I've got T-Mobile. Listen, T-Mobile isn't just talking the talk. They're taking measures right now to make life easier for everyone by doing the right thing for their customers during this really critical time. For example, T-Mobile has ensured all current customers with data plans have access to unlimited smartphone data on their network for 2 months. We're all in this together. T-Mobile truly believes that. And while many T-Mobile stores are temporarily closed to help keep customers and employees healthy, they've still got you covered with any help you need. Just check out T-Mobile.com. You can see what stores are still open and how you can manage your account online. Stay safe out there. During congestion, customers using more than 50 gigs a month may notice reduced speeds prioritization, video typically at 480p, capable device required. Wow, how things can change from 1 week to the next. Hey, hope everybody out there is staying healthy. I know everything is super crazy. We feel disoriented by the COVID-19 virus. It's more important than ever to stay connected and check in with your loved ones. That's why I'm so happy I've got T-Mobile. Listen, T-Mobile isn't just talking the talk. They're taking measures right now to make life easier for everyone by doing the right thing for their customers during this really critical time. For example, T-Mobile has ensured all current customers with data plans have access to unlimited smartphone data on their network for 2 months. We're all in this together. T-Mobile truly believes that. And while many T-Mobile stores are temporarily closed to help keep customers and employees healthy, they've still got you covered with any help you need. Just check out T-Mobile.com. You can see what stores are still open and how you can manage your account online. Stay safe out there. During congestion, customers using more than 50 gigs a month may notice reduced speeds prioritization, video typically at 480p, capable device required.